We're very excited and honored to have the acting chairman of the Federal Trade Commission here with us today. She's a good friend to the organization, also a good personal friend. I've known her for years. She served at the commission for 11 years. That was sort of mentioned or alluded to by Senator Cruz, and became a commissioner in 2012 before being designated to serve in her current position in January of this year. Chairman Olhausen is an expert in privacy and trade law, and before working for the commission, she was an adjunct faculty at Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University, where she taught about privacy and unfair trade practices and wrote a number of articles on antitrust competition law. There, she was also senior editor of the Antitrust Law Journal and a member of the ABA's Task Force on Competition and Public Policy. She later worked at Wilkins & Barker Knauer, the law firm here in Washington, D.C., where she became a partner specializing in FTC issues. I mentioned at the outset she's a great friend of the organization. She's also a good personal friend. Please join me in welcoming Acting Chairman of the FTC Commission, Maureen Olhausen.
Well, thank you, Dean, and to the Federalist Society for hosting me today. I'm thrilled to be here with so many friends and colleagues who've worked on these issues with me over the years and who I know care deeply about them as I do. I'm also so pleased to follow my former boss and old friend, Senator Ted Cruz. You can see what an inspiring boss he must have been when he was leading the FTC's Office of Policy Planning. And I'm really delighted to say that even all these years later, we are both continuing to work hard to advance the economic liberty of American people. And I'm honored to build on his thoughtful remarks. I'm also having trouble getting my, there we go. My little stand onto the podium. So my ongoing fight for economic liberty is fueled by my personal belief in the power and the benefits of free markets. Now, we sometimes take free markets and competition for granted, and we treat these institutions as if they've always existed or if they just sprung forth fully formed. But these important institutions exist only where individuals are free to exercise their economic liberties. So the liberty to own, to exchange, to compete, and the most relevant for today's topic, the liberty to pursue work at a job of one's own choosing. These individual economic liberties exercised en masse foster free markets. And the benefits of free markets include innovation, new business models, economic opportunity, jobs, put simply, and financial growth, and greater access for consumers to more and better products at lower prices. And these benefits and more come from free markets. And free markets are only possible because of economic liberty. Now, because I believe economic liberty is so important, indeed fundamental to our American way of life, I've spent much of my career working to advance it. And I'm particularly proud of the work, of my role in the work started in 2001 by Chairman Tim Urist, as Senator Cruz mentioned, which along with our advocacy, we also worked to limit antitrust immunity for anti-competitive private actions under the color of state authority. And that work set the foundation for some of our recent successes, most notably the FTC Supreme Court victory in the North Carolina dental case. But despite such important court wins, far too many job-seeking Americans still face a sea of government red tape between them and the job that they want to do. And the FTC's mission is to protect consumers. And sometimes, as in occupational licensing, that may mean protecting consumers from excessive government regulation. And today, I'd like to tell you a little bit more about how, as acting chairman of the FTC, I will carry out my commitment to economic liberty with a particular focus today on occupational licensing. So the most durable restrictions on competition typically flow from government. Government overreach diminishes economic opportunities. And such overreach can also happen at the behest of market participants. So where an innovator needs permission from the government to enter a market, I call it the mother may I problem. But there's also a brother may I problem. And that problem occurs when a competitor controls market entry, often through some kind of regulatory permission. And in either case, such regulations can endure for decades. So some occupational licensing is essential to protect our public health and safety. But when abused, unnecessary, or excessive, licensing threatens our economic liberty. And the trend here is not good. In the 1950s, less than 5% of jobs required a license. And today, nearly 30% of jobs require one. And some studies suggest that the result has been over 250 million fewer jobs and billions of dollars in costs to consumers. And today, licensing requirements go far beyond doctors and nurses and electricians and school bus drivers. And now they extend to auctioneers, interior designers, florists, makeup artists, hair braiders, and numerous other occupations. The public safety and health rationale for regulating many of these occupations ranges from the dubious to ridiculous. Consumers can easily evaluate the quality of interior designers, makeup artists, hair braiders, florists, and others. And consumers already do. Market dynamics naturally weed out bad service providers without placing consumers in harm's way. For many other occupations, added regulation limits the number of providers and drives up prices. And these costs often dwarf any public health or safety need and ultimately harm consumers by limiting their access to better and new services. Now, other evidence suggests that such regulations are unnecessary or overly strict. So studies by the Institute of Justice, I'm delighted that Clark is here today, his organization's done a fantastic job in this space. So IJ and other organizations have found that different states regulate different occupations. So all states have licensing requirements for about 60 occupations, such as doctors and school bus drivers and truck drivers. But more than 1,000 jobs are licensed in one state, that are licensed in one state, remain completely unlicensed in another. And moreover, states impose very different licensing requirements, such as the number of months of training required, even for the exact same occupation. And this uneven licensing of the same occupation and different requirements for the same license across states strongly suggests that many occupational licenses don't advance public health safety or other legitimate public protections. Now, the growth of unnecessary and overbroad occupational licensing hurts many average Americans who want to enter these occupations. And as Senator Cruz already mentioned, lower and middle income Americans are especially impacted, but as are military families and veterans. For example, because military families move a lot, occupational licensing blocks jobs opportunities for what we call the trailing spouse, one who goes along with them. And a new state may have additional or different licensing requirements that that trailing spouse must fulfill simply to practice his or her profession in that state. And occupational licensing also blocks veterans seeking to return to civilian employment. And these folks deserve better. So if such regulations aren't protecting consumers, why do they exist? So often such regulations reflect regulatory capture, replacement, or overreach. Indeed, as in the FTC's North Carolina dental case, it's often not the state government acting, but self-interested active market participants imposing occupational licensing requirements to prevent competition. Now, public choice theory recognizes that regulators are most likely to grant private economic gain to special interests when the cost of that concentrated benefit can be spread among many consumers, a bunch of consumers paying a little bit of extra cost, but a concentrated benefit to the practitioners. And unfortunately, occupational licensing is really the poster child for that phenomenon. By protecting themselves from competition, incumbents in an industry can often limit choices and raise their prices, gaining at the expense of everyone else. So this brother may I problem is precisely what I would like to work with interested parties, including the states, to prevent and eliminate. Now, often state and local legislators are only hearing from one side of the story, from the party who will receive the concentrated benefit. And they often don't hear about how such regulations will impose costs on the very constituents they wish to protect. And state and local legislators must hear both sides of the story. So to be clear, I believe in federalism and the important principles that embodies. And I am a member of the Federalist Society, after all, and have been for a long time. If politically accountable state actors clearly articulate a policy and decide to displace competition with state regulation, and then actively supervise it if they need to, we at the federal level must and should respect that decision, and their constituents will hold them accountable. Often, however, such regulation reflects not the express will of the people through the political process, but rather regulatory capture by a narrow group of special interests. It often lacks accountability to the state's legislators and voters and imposes high costs on consumers. And this is especially true when a state delegates regulatory authority to a licensing board controlled by the profession itself. And studies suggest that in some states, market participants control more than 90% of the licensing boards. And when market participants control state boards that impose regulations on competitors, self-interest may well supersede consumer welfare. So what can the FTC do? A lot, and we're doing it. So I've created an economic liberty task force within the FTC to advance economic liberty with a particular focus on reducing occupational licensing regulations. And I've been thrilled with the reception that this task force has received so far. People are very interested in this. And we've heard, or I've heard, from state legislators, governors, consumers organizations, news outlets, and individuals across the country who are interested in what we're doing and looking to team up to bring back economic opportunity. And the task force has already started coordinating the use of the FTC's tools to increase economic liberty. So we have two primary tools, advocacy and enforcement. Senator Cruz talked about our advocacy work. So since the 1970s, the commission has issued hundreds of advocacy comments and amicus briefs to state boards and self-regulated entities. So as a first step, my economic liberty task force has collected the materials on these past advocacy efforts into a special area of the FTC website focused on economic liberty. And this portal, which you all can find at ftc.gov/econliberty, highlights the FTC's important work on competition advocacy and occupational licensing. And it also gathers the many existing FTC resources into a central repository for other stakeholders, and it showcases select state-based occupational licensing reform efforts. And we're continuing to expand resources at this site, and we welcome your suggestions. So you can email suggestions to the task force at econlibertytaskforce@ftc.gov. Now, as the next step, the task force is seeking input from an array of parties and trying to build partnerships. Now, fortunately, many people, including state leaders, want to expand economic opportunity. And this is a time of change, and many Americans are demanding less regulation and more economic opportunity. And I hope to create a new level of partnership with governors and state AGs and state legislative leaders and other state and local officials. So I've got good reason for optimism in developing these partnerships. And governors and legislators in many states are already identifying problematic occupational licenses. So earlier, here's just one example. Earlier this year, Governor Pete Ricketts of Nebraska launched an occupational licensing reform initiative. And things are moving pretty quickly there. And in fact, the FTC's Office of Policy Planning just submitted comments on 4 Nebraska reform bills. And building on this effort, last week, the FTC hosted a Twitter chat with me and Governor Ricketts' office. And I was very heartened by the enthusiastic response that we received. So through partnerships, the task force will continue the FTC's efforts to help states include competition analysis when reviewing new and existing regulations. So by combining the FTC's expertise and stakeholders' knowledge in partnership with state actors, I believe we can help improve competition, help Americans seeking jobs allow innovation to flourish, and enhance consumer choice. Now, of course, in some instances, enforcement may be an appropriate tool, consistent with the Supreme Court's ruling in the North Carolina dental case and other state action cases. But the primary work of the FTC's Economic Liberty Task Force will be advocacy and partnership. So, just to wrap up here and get to our wonderful panel discussion, the late Jack Kemp said, "There are no limits to our future if we don't put limits on our people." Limits on economic liberty not only hurt the economy and the free market system, they also hurt American consumers and workers in their everyday lives. And as the country struggles to revitalize economic opportunity for everyone, we have a unique chance to challenge unnecessary occupational licensing. So together with the many excellent reform organizations and with state and local and federal partners, we can remove long-standing barriers to competition and therefore expand economic liberty. So thank you, and I look forward to the discussion. Table mic. Excellent. Thank you.
Did we get your name tag,
Maureen? There we go. I think you should know who I am. Excellent. So, to my left is Larry Spiwak, president of the Phoenix Center for Advanced Legal and Economic Policy Studies. It's a nonprofit center that studies broad public policy issues related to governance, social, and economic conditions, with a particular emphasis on law and economics of the digital age. To his left is Dr. Michelle Connolly, professor of the practice in the economics department at Duke University. I'm not sure I said that right. Professor Connolly's research and teaching focuses on international trade, telecommunications policy, media policy, education, growth, and development. Last but not least, we have Clark Neely, who joined the Institute for Justice as a senior attorney in 2000. And actually, it was really fun, Clark, as Senator Cruz was talking about the casket issue. That's how I first met you, right? So I helped draft an FTC brief on this idea that you had to be a funeral director to sell caskets. And the people who were defending it said, well, the FTC has this rule. And so we got to draft a brief that says that is not what that rule says, and that's not what it means. So each panelist will start off with some opening remarks. So Larry?
Well, thank you very much. It's a delight to be here. I was trying to tell my liberal friends that I was going to be doing a Federal Society event, and I was trying to describe what we do here. And I don't know if you all read the Wall Street Journal on Friday. It was a lead editorial on Judge Gorsuch, but this quote's just too good. Quote, excuse me. You think the Federalist Society is some secret society in Dan Brown novel. As far as we know, their conferences are public, and no torture rituals are involved. Am I at the right place? All right, just checking. Okay. So, without question, and I'm so glad that Maureen is highlighting this. This is such a big deal for the American economy to get it moving and sort of the overreach of government and regulation. And without question that occupational licensing has a huge effect on our economy. Even the Obama administration, right before they left office, their Council of Economic Advisors put out a piece, said roughly one quarter of U.S. workers require occupational licensing. So this is something that is very much in our economy. So just to get the discussion started, let's just talk about for a moment sort of what's the rationale for occupational licensing. And I thought about it a lot, and I came to the conclusion that it's what I like to call the Holiday Inn test. What do you mean by the Holiday Inn test? Why, you're about to perform brain surgery on me. Are you a doctor? Why, no, I stayed in the Holiday Inn Express, right? That's the argument, right? We don't want untrained people doing things that could harm consumers, right? And not only that, because it is a license, the argument is that if there is some sort of malfeasance, that you could then take that license away and you'll never be able to practice in that field again and be banished to eternity. So that's the argument in favor of that. And obvious examples, doctors, and let's face it, folks, we're all largely lawyers in this room, and we all have an occupational license. There's a degree of technique and skill with that, and we're officers of the court. However, as Maureen has pointed out, very often the public health and safety rationales or other rationales, and I love this line, range from the dubious to the ridiculous. And I think that really is true. So I think when you start talking about occupational licensing, I mean, there's some hard questions involved here, right? Because public safety there is some legitimate nut there to do this. So what are we trying to achieve, arguably, with occupational licensing? Well, are we trying to establish some sort of minimum certification, right? We all went to law school for 3 years and took the bar and had to take professional responsibility exam. Okay, well, that could be there, but is that a government requirement, right? And by way of example, my wife is in the makeup industry. She's run several counters. She runs the Charlotte Tilbury counter over at Nordstrom's and Tyson's. Okay, now to get that job to run the makeup counter, she had to get certified as a makeup artist because there are certain health issues involved with putting makeup on people's faces. But she didn't need a certification. Now, if she wanted to be an esthetician, which involves quasi-medical stuff, then she does have to get a license. But, you know, clearly the market dictated whether or not you're qualified or not. If I want to be a mechanic, well, I might have been, you know, grew up on a farm. I don't look like I grew up on a farm. But, you know, and I've worked on tractors my whole life, and I'm, you know, I can rebuild something with, you know, my wrench and blindfold. Okay, I don't need certification. But the market can determine whether or not you're a good mechanic or not. And you have a reputational aspect of that. So, again, a lot of these issues are you don't need that, and the market can take care of that, assuming that there's no public health and safety. But where then is the rub? And I think for me, a lot of occupational licensing, the reality, what's driving this is although I think what Maureen raised with the brother may I is a large degree, but I really think that it comes down to it is just a very convenient source for local and state governments to extract rents in the form of another form of a tax. DC government tried that a couple of years ago where in addition to our bar dues, we're going to have to pay a professional fee. And it's just very easy just to attach. It's one thing, okay, I'm going to pay $25, but I mean, I'm reading some of the literature, just the outrageous what they cost for an annual license. And this is just a way of taxing. So it's not even, to me, I think, even a way of you know, I don't think there's any shortage of lawyers out there, by way of example, but it's a way that the government can extract a tax if you want to do business. And then when you tax something, you get less of it or certainly less quality of it. So again, and we'll go for the bigger discussion of, you know, what is that compelling license? And then more importantly, and I look forward to the discussion, what is exactly that we do about this? I think Senator Cruz had a very excellent point about sunshine is the best disinfectant, and maybe that's a lot. These are very entrenched interests, and then you couple that with revenue to a state. Sometimes shame is your best policy, although some administrations have no shame. You know, do we do some sort of preemption? I mean, you run into a 10th Amendment issue. Do we have an antitrust concern? And we talk about the North Carolina dentist. And then you even have a due process concern, and we'll talk about this when we start talking about some of the law, but I did a piece, and it just reminded me, listening to Maureen's speech, I do a lot of work on dealing with municipal broadband where it's the government fighting the private sector, and that's never a good idea. And there was actually a case last year out of the D.C. Circuit dealing with railroads, and they sued Amtrak, and it turns out the D.C. Circuit ruled the Amtrak statute unconstitutional, violates due process, because in that case what the court found was that essentially you can't be both a competitor and a regulator at the same time, even if you are nominally the government. That just violates all basic things. So these are all avenues in how we pursue that, but I think that's the way to just start the discussion about a very complicated issue. So I'll turn that over to my good friend, Michelle.
Thank you. Thank you. So as the only economist on the stage, and unlicensed, because there is no license, but I think we haven't really had to argue for that because it doesn't seem that droves of people are running to get econ degrees, so I think we're safe. So as Larry was mentioning, there are many legitimate health and safety concerns, issues about asymmetric information that justify the use of licenses in certain professions. A couple things to note, though, is that the market is changing rapidly, and certainly the internet is something that's very quickly changing the issue of asymmetric information, and certainly helps with issues of rogue actors. Also, it's not clear to me, or at least I haven't seen any studies that really demonstrate, even in cases of health or safety considerations, that the outcomes in states with more stringent or more onerous licensing requirements, if they actually have demonstrably better health outcomes, health or safety outcomes, that seems something that might be worth considering. Now, this panel is really focusing on the cases where there are not so many legitimate reasons for arguing for occupational licenses. I have stolen a lot of details from the Institute for Justice, so thank you for that, and sorry if I preempt you. It's very obvious when we see that there are widely varying requirements for the same type of license in different states. If these requirements are so crucial, then that would argue they would need to be quite harmonized. It's also very obvious when only a few states have licenses for particular occupations. So the one that I really loved was for interior designers. There are only three states that require it, plus the District of Columbia. So you will all be happy to know that you are protected
from
bad designers. And in D.C. in 2012, to get a license as an interior designer in D.C., you had to pay $925, have 6 years of combined education and experience, and pass an exam. I don't know what the exam looked like. Do you?
Oh, yeah. It's a bar exam for interior designers.
Oh, it's excellent. You know, and then obvious other examples are shampooing, florist, cosmetologist, tree trimmer, which I'll get back to later, teacher's assistant, and sign language interpreter. Sorry. You need an interpreter for me as well. Now, clearly, in economics, we call this a barrier to entry. And this is the exclusion of new members. This exclusion is promoted by either existing members or by potentially competing professions. The types of barriers are multiple. There are cost barriers. Even a relatively small fee of a few hundred dollars can be an effective barrier for someone in a low-income situation. Time is a very effective barrier. If you have many years of time where you are not able to earn a living because you have to satisfy this experience requirement, if you're from a low-income household, again, that's going to be a sufficient barrier for you to not be able to join this occupation. And then we have an even more extreme case of caps on the numbers of licenses. So the most well-known example are certain cities put total caps on the number of licenses for taxis. As a consequence, the license itself becomes a commodity. The medallions in New York City go for over $1 million each. I don't find that the quality of my cab service in New York City is worth $1 million. I also thought I'd add a term that I haven't really seen within this discussion, but it's a term we use in economics. It's called dupes, directly unproductive profit-seeking activities. And the definition of this is an activity that uses real resources in rent-seeking activities in order to increase profits, but it itself produces no output. The key about dupes, and this can exist, this is clearly a situation when we have some of these unreasonable licenses. We also have it in trade policy and many other economic scenarios. But it's always promoted by organized groups, and as Maureen was saying, concentrated groups, which makes it easy for them to organize and have an incentive to get these concentrated benefits. And it's at the cost, in this case, of two groups. It's the cost of potential entrants, who are usually without much money and not organized, have no real means of organizing, and at the cost of consumers who also are not easily organized to lobby against this. Also, the consumers may have relatively small costs. As a social group, it's a huge cost, but the individual doesn't have the incentive to try to lobby against it. And this makes regulatory capture very easy. Unless we want to be more benevolent and simply say this is regulatory overreach. But the results of directly, of dupes, I'll call them dupes because I like that term, is that it restricts production and employment, it raises prices, and it harms both potential market entrants and consumers. And one thing that I thought was very interesting about what others have said is that the key about the harm to potential entrants and what effects that has. So I was looking at the Institute for Justice report and the professions that were being hit by that. And if you look at the population that is in those occupations, The average income is around $30,000, slightly more men than women. But what is very interesting is that men and minorities are overrepresented in this group relative to the general population. So this is the exact socioeconomic, these are socioeconomic groups that we observe in economics are having significant problems with long-term underemployment or unemployment. So these are exactly the occupations where you want to lower those barriers to help them, and they're the people who are getting hit by it. And they're usually getting hit by it by other professional groups who are making much more money and simply don't want lower cost competition. The second thing that I noticed from Maureen's statements is that because of the differences in the state licenses and lack of reciprocity across states, this harms labor mobility at a national level. And the example of the military wives is illustrative, but more generally, when we look in economics at any kind of shock, whether it's a technological shock, an industrial shock, a trade shock, it gets concentrated on certain industries. And those are usually geographically located. And if we had a great deal of national labor mobility, then the workers are able to move to other areas and the shock gets dissipated much more quickly. So much of the harm that our workers incur when there are these massive exterior shocks is because there is a lack of labor mobility for many reasons. But to the extent that we know that these types of licenses are only increasing that, we know that that's only amplifying the negative shocks to these workers. It's going to be important for spouses like military spouses, but really for spouses of any dual income household where the primary earner has a need either because of a shock or for a positive reason to move to another state. So again, these licenses are hampering the socioeconomic group that's having the hardest time in terms of long-term under or unemployment. Now, just so I don't sound too against certain things, okay, and this, no one will really be able to see this. I wanted to put this on a slide. But I'm going to provide evidence that people could use to argue you do need licenses for certain things. This is what I do on the weekends, which is my chainsaw, my steel chainsaw. And people could argue that that is a, you know, social security issue, but just to have something positive.
Thank you, Michelle. Clark?
Well, when you started talking about dupes, I was afraid you really had stolen my thunder, because I'm here to talk about the role of judges in failing to protect economic liberty, and fortunately it was just an acronym. I'd actually like to push back on this premise that there are some jobs that justify occupational licensing. I'll give you an analogy. I mean, I've done nothing but I've done a lot of occupational licensing litigation in the 17 years I've been with the Institute for Justice. I should give a shout out to my friends Josh Windham and Rob Johnson, who are in the back. To paraphrase Yogi Berra, I'd rather fight for economic liberty than with the best people in the world. Imagine if you have a couple of toddlers, as I do at home, and you have a problem with rats. Fortunately, we're in a rental house, so it's not actually my fault. We do. Now, one possible way of dealing with the rats would be to bring in some timber wolves. And those are the regulators. And these particular timber wolves are wild, ravenous, and malign. Now, is that a rational way to deal with your pest problem, is to bring in some timber wolves? They're going to be real effective in going after the rats, unlike regulators going after incompetent practitioners. What you discover very quickly is that that when you create a regulatory body with the idea of excluding incompetent practitioners and going after unethical licensees, they don't do any of that. They devote virtually all of their effort to keeping out non-licensees. That's what they do. It's called regulatory capture. It's a Nobel Prize winning theory. You can look it up. But occupational licensing, whatever hopes we might have for it, completely fails to pass the test of empirical analysis. There's virtually no economic data to suggest that it does anything good, and abundant economic data to show that it's absolutely disastrous for productivity and for innovation. Why is America the wealthiest, most prosperous nation the world has ever seen? Well, I think it's because we are a country in which people have always felt that if you come here, you will be able to reap the just rewards of your effort, of your industry. And I'm going to put the emphasis on just and come back to that in a moment. Anybody know what the most patented device in the history of America is?
Mousetrap.
It's a mousetrap. 4,400 patents, 95% of them to first-time amateur inventors. Why do people keep on inventing mousetraps? Is it for the fame of being the most recent of those 4,400 mousetraps? No. Is it for the sheer creative joy of inventing? No, it's to make money. It's to make money. And either America is going to be a place that encourages that kind of innovation or we're not. And we are sliding very quickly in world rankings of economic liberty. Why? Because we are abandoning the rule of law. It is no longer the case that America would stand head and shoulders above every other country in the world if you were an inventor and you had something amazing to bring to market and you got to pick any country in the world. There was a time when it would be a no-brainer, and that time has passed. Depending on what survey you look at, we're something around 15 or 16 in the world rankings of economic liberty, and we're sinking. Why? Because we are abandoning the rule of law. Why are we abandoning the rule of law? Because our judiciary is systematically failing to fulfill its role as a truly independent branch of government and to give any meaningful substance to the Supreme Court's longstanding recognition that each and every one of us has a constitutional right to earn a living free from unreasonable government interference. They say it, and they have said it for over a century, and for the past 65 years, they haven't meant it. How do we know? Because they protect this so-called right with something called the rational basis test, which, for those of you who don't practice law, is a fraud and a charade invented by the Supreme Court to provide the appearance of judicial review with none of the substance. If I sound a little exercised, it's because I've been litigating rational basis cases like Captain Ahab for the past 15 years. But we're going to put a harpoon through the cold black heart of the rational basis test, I'm sure. Here's why it's extraordinarily important. There are two reasons. I don't want to illustrate it with an actual case. When you're in the business of trying to vindicate economic liberty, you have to look for the most ridiculous occupational licensing laws you can find. Why? Because so many people have a preconception, right? Show me a picture of a chainsaw. Ah! Surely some bureaucrat must be in charge of who can pick that thing up. My sister's a doctor in Maine. Virtually everybody thinks she should be licensed. I used to, by the way, but I've known too many regulators in the time I've been working. Oh, and by the way, let me add one thing to affirm a point Senator Cruz made. I wish I had a dollar for every time I've been litigating an economic liberty case, and we get to a break in a deposition or something like that, and my opposing counsel, if we still have a good relationship, which is sometimes, during a break will look at me and say, Clark, I was on your website last night, and I was looking at some of your cases, and I'm going to tell you, I totally agree with you on all those other economic liberty cases. I mean, not this one. This one is different, but all those other ones, and it happens all the time. So, craziest law we ever found, occupational licensing law. Louisiana, alone among the states, requires a license to be a florist. Not making that up. Take two flowers, put them together in an aesthetically appealing way. Probably we're okay with the centerpieces because I only see one flower. But if you put another one in that vase, that would be illegal to do in Louisiana without a government-issued license. At the time we challenged that law in 2003, they had a licensing exam that required would-be florists to come and do four floral arrangements in 4 hours that they would then have to take up to a table at which were sitting judges who were not theoretically disinterested bureaucrats. You got to hand it to Louisiana. They never do anything halfway when it comes to this kind of stuff. They would bring working florists in from the industry to judge your work and determine if you were good enough to compete with them. Anybody want to guess what they usually said? 65% fail rate on the Louisiana florist exam. It was actually harder to become a florist in Louisiana than to become a lawyer. The bar exam had a 67% pass rate. So, go figure. All right. Does anybody really wonder why the state of Louisiana licenses florists? Do I sound like I'm asking a rhetorical question? I'm not. I've actually only ever met one person who had some wonder, who actually did not know why this law was. I've talked to people on airplanes. I've talked to little kids who just fell off a turnip truck. The only person I've ever met who had some question about why this law was enacted was wearing a robe. Not making that up. A federal judge upheld this law, partly on the basis of the alleged but totally false physical dangers of unlicensed floristry. which apparently include infected dirt and misplaced corsage pins. It's written. You can look it up. All right. So what are we going to do about this? Well, I think what needs to happen is the judiciary needs to get back in the business of fulfilling its customary truth-seeking role. I don't actually care that much whether they strike down these laws or uphold these laws. What I care a lot about is that they stop lending their imprimatur to this kind of corruption. And I'll say that again. This is corruption. When the state of Louisiana requires a license to be a florist, that is a corrupt abuse of power, and we've got to get the judiciary out of the business of rubber stamping it. Again, I don't care that much whether you strike it down or uphold it, but don't pretend to believe it. When the state of Louisiana comes in and says, somehow with a straight face, I don't know how he did it, my opposing counsel, that a possible explanation for licensing florists is the physical dangers of unlicensed floristry. That's not true, and that shouldn't fly in a court of justice. Again, whatever the standard of review might be. So there are a variety of things we can do, I think, to move from here to there. My colleague Rob Johnson has actually written a wonderful brochure. Tell them what the name of the brochure is, Rob. Licensing Boards Behaving Badly. You can look it up. And we have a whole suite of suggestions, and what it boils down to essentially is occupational licensing should not be a policy of first resort as it is now. It should be a policy of last resort. And we have this beautiful inverted pyramid to convey graphically that there's like a dozen different things you can do if you have concerns about chainsaw-waving weekend warriors who happen to go out and, I guess, open a shingle as an arborist or whatever. By the way, that's a heavily regulated industry, in case you didn't know. So that's the takeaway, two things. We need the judiciary to get back in the business of at least not pretending to believe what no one would believe. Get back in their customary truth-seeking role and saying, hey, you know what? I'm not telling you what to do, but I am telling you, you're not licensing florists to protect the public. Done. Second, convince policymakers to flip their approach. Do not go to occupational licensing as a policy of first resort. It is a policy of last resort. Okay.
Thanks, Clark, and thank you for Yes, I love your Captain Ahab reference there. You're getting the full from hell's heart, I stab at thee, you know, effect here. So excellent. So everyone, I think, has done a fantastic job of sort of touching on these different factors that play into why we have occupational licensing, why we shouldn't have occupational licensing. I think one of the interesting factors as well is it's often seen as a binary yes or no thing rather than, you know, should we have certification? Should this particular practice be licensed that only a dentist can do it rather than a dental therapist or something like that? So there's lots of complexities here. But I'm going to jump right to the last question, and because I want to have time for audience questions, is what else can we do or should we be doing to try to make a dent in this? You know, the tools at the federal level are somewhat limited. Right, I often get that question. What are you going to do? You know, we did the North Carolina dental case. We've tried to clean up the case law on state action immunity. I've tried to shine a spotlight on it. We've done our advocacy. What else are we missing? What else can we be doing? So I'll just sort of throw that open to the panel.
Well, I'll start, I guess, if I may. So a couple things, I think, to get sort of a little more specific. The Supreme Court has got to decide where it stands on this question of occupational licensing. This was there's an extraordinary William O. Douglas quote, and there's a case in which he says in dissent that I had always thought that the right to earn a living was the most precious right that man possesses. And then within a year, he wrote the worst occupational licensing decision in Supreme Court history, a case called Williamson v. Lee Optical in, I think it was 1954 or 55. And that, to me, illustrates the extraordinary cognitive dissonance on this point. And if you actually look at any test the Supreme Court has ever promulgated for determining what is a fundamental right, which is Supreme Court speak for meaningful, the right to earn a living and put food on your family's table undoubtedly qualifies. And so this failure to step up and provide any meaningful protection for economic liberty is not an act of judicial principle. It's an act of judicial abdication. And so point one is that the courts need to get back in the business of treating occupational freedom like the fundamental right that it is. And I think this would tend to provoke a kind of an important dialogue where instead of another thing that Senator Cruz said that I agree very strongly with is the truth is important. And right now, we have the judiciary participating in a truth-hiding process with the other branches. Take an antitrust case, for example. They try to get at the truth in those cases. But an economic liberty case, quite the opposite. They try to suppress the truth. So I think if we could get the courts and the legislature into an honest dialogue about what are the legitimate ends of government and are you exercising power legitimately in this case, we would begin to see positive motion. It wouldn't be an overnight cure. There's no such thing. But this would begin to move us in the direction of an honest national dialogue about the abuse of this power, which we are absolutely not having right now.
So, Michelle, you are an unlicensed doctor sitting up here on the stage with us, right? Yeah. You have a PhD.
No one cares about the health of Duke students.
Right, yes. Yeah. So is there any sort of economic test that we should be applying here to say whether this is, you know, a worthwhile type of regulation or whether we're into the economic protectionism, deadweight loss world?
I think a lot of studies could be done. Labor economists could certainly work on this. And there are also many dimensions in with which to attack this. One are, you know, there are positive claims by those arguing this helps. So does it? If there's no evidence of that, that lowers the relevance of that claim. Secondly, we could look at things like does it interfere with growth and productivity and employment? And since we have state-by-state variation, that can help. We could also look at cross-country variation in these things. So certainly empirical studies, I think, give you tools and evidence that could be put forward. And I think, unfortunately, many of these things are based on hypotheses or opinion or scare tactics and aren't based on any kind of empirical evidence. Unfortunately, I was very surprised at how little the economics literature has done on this because it seems almost self-evident to the economists.
I was actually in the audience when the North Carolina dental case was being argued, because, you know, this FTC case. And it was very interesting to me to see the presumption that a lot of the justices had, that if you had higher licensing standard, it would create better outcomes for consumers, and a complete sort of blind spot as to the access issues, right? So it's the idea, yes, wouldn't it all be great if we all drove, you know, very expensive cars and they would be safer, but without paying attention to all the people that would be walking, right? And so that's one of the issues I think may be worth studying, right? For example, in a state where you didn't have a license or you had a lower license for certain healthcare providers, do you actually have better outcomes because it has improved access? And the FTC has actually filed comments to allow nurse practitioners into the big box retailers, right, to get the flu shot, the ear infection, those kinds of things treated in a lower cost setting at hours that are convenient for people who don't necessarily get to take an hour of sick leave to go do something like that. So I love your suggestion. So, Larry, do you have any your idea, your insight that a lot of this is basically money-generating activity for the state, I think has some appeal to it. But one of the problems that I see is that you may pay a $200 license fee to the state, but they may also require you to have, you know, 270 hours of training to be a hair braider. Mm-hmm. The state isn't reaping that
right.
benefit.
Right.
So do you see any way to sort of make progress on that?
Well, I think it comes down to, I just go back to what Senator Cruz was saying. I mean, sunlight is the best disinfectant. I mean, when one does public policy, and I've been doing this for a long time, one never has the giant eureka moment and go, I am so sorry, I was wrong. You know, firms are not passive recipients of regulation. They manipulate the system. That's the environment that we live in. And so sunshine, I mean, again, there are, at the 90,000-foot level, there are some compelling reasons for occupational licensing. I don't think you can do that. I mean, Clark, I mean, there was, I remember in high school reading about the 1792 outbreak of tetanus from rusty corsage pins that a lot of people don't know about. It's very dangerous, and you have to be very careful about this. We'd hate to have that happen again. But I mean, the fact that I think, Maureen, that you're bringing attention to this, and again, your line that, you know, we go from the sublime to the ridiculous, And each case is going to be different. Again, with exception of Michelle, we're all lawyers on this panel, right? We all take, and I use that as the most personal example, but, you know, I'm not interested in the unlicensed practice of law. I remember years ago, I was watching David Bowie on MTV, and he was painting with David Bowie, and they said, David, what is the definition of art? He says, well, art is obviously in the eye of the beholder. Anybody should be able to paint if they want to, but it also implies some degree of expertise and technique if one's going to be professional about it. So you do have some compelling state interest, but it's this excess. So again, going back to what I said earlier, the market may demand qualifications, and the market can decide whether or not it wants. Again, I use the example of if you want to be a professional makeup artist, there are some safety issues involved because you don't want people touching with dirty brushes and so forth and so on. Now, maybe you grew up and you learned this, but you know the market may demand that. That's not going to mean that you couldn't open up your own salon and then people go, I don't know if I want to go over there, it's kind of dirty. But again, the market can govern that. So the requirements, I mean, you know, it's interesting. Here's a great example. Montgomery County is perfect. It just popped in my head. The battle between volunteer firefighters and the unions is huge in Montgomery County, Maryland. And the unions have done everything that they can to drive people who are voluntarily willing to run into a burning building and save people. That's absolutely ridiculous. So you see this all the time that we've had. And so, again, I go back to the point of public policy making is an incremental process. It's always, you know, baby steps forward. It's victory at the margins. So the fact that you are calling attention to this is phenomenal because nobody has done this before. I mean, you know, you've had the Obama administration kind of talked about it a little bit, but now you actually have the acting chair of the FTC going, this is a major issue. If the goal is to get jobs, if the goal is to drive the economy, this is clearly a problem. It is a complex problem, but now we are focusing attention to it. And very often in public policy, when the you know squeaky wheel gets greased, that's what you do. Because again, you know, you highlighted earlier, I mean, you have the brother may I problem added on to the states. And I think what's interesting, just going back to the law for a moment, having reread the North Carolina dentist case before this event, I mean, what was interesting about all the, with the exceptions of, I think, Justice Roberts, the conservative wings, Alito and Scalia and I think Thomas wrote in the dissent, you know, their view of Illinois dentists was in the Parker v. Brown immunity was, no, the dentistry board was actually an action of the government. So it wasn't part of, you know, you get into the active state supervision, so forth and so on, and whether or not dentistry includes teeth whitening. So, but the point is that policy starts, and as you've done, as Senator Cruz says, by bringing attention. That's how the process gets starts. And then, as Senator Cruz said, I think so brilliantly, when you start highlighting, you want to screw your consumers, be at it. But, you know, I'm on record, and here's, which then goes, and with Michelle's talking about, a good analytical story. You know, this is a very personal thing to a lot of people, and so unless you have the good analytical story with the good data, then all this doesn't mean anything, then you turn it into an ideological fight. And I think that is probably the most pro-consumer thing that that you can do.
So I think we have a few minutes for questions. Is there a microphone to? Okay. Maybe Steve DelBianco first.
Thank you, Steve DelBianco of NetChoice. And Maureen, you put a restraint on those of us in the room who believe in federalism to say that this town can't really issue mandates or preemption to the states, but there's an opening. The states have no such compunction about preempting city and county governments. And where, as Michelle pointed out, occupational licensing with respect to taxis is only the beginning of it. Fairfax County, where Larry lives, occupational license on folks who do personal training at the gym. And then turn to another economic
liberty. I live in the People's Republic of Maryland, so I'm sorry.
Okay. But the economic liberty of people who have an asset, like a home, and they have property rights, and they want to be able to rent a room or a home on Airbnb or HomeAway, again, all of those regulations are city and county level. So I think we can partner with state legislators who believe in economic liberty and property rights for them to run bills that preempt local authority with statewide standards. We could have a full agenda of a year's worth of grid legislation and solve a lot of the problems without violating a federalist principle.
Great. Thank you, Steve. This gentleman here. And I hope you'll send us an email with your ideas to econliberty.
For certain health and safety occupations, I can understand the argument for licensing in favor of nothing at all. But if you just compare licensing to a system of registration and requiring them to post a bond for any damages they cause, is there any advantage for the licensing compared to that kind of system?
No. No, the answer is no. Can you hear me? The answer is no. But really quickly, while I have the mic, if I could revise and extend my remarks about judges. There are some really amazing ones out there. Janice Rogers Brown and David Sintel wrote a concurrence in a case involving federal milk regulation in which they applied rational basis review, which they were obliged to do, upheld the law, which they were probably obliged to do, and then Judge Brown went off on many of the things we've been talking about and really pulled the veil back on both the legality and the wisdom of putting in the hands of people who gave us the food pyramid to put them in charge of regulating occupations. These people who told us the best things to eat are French fries, Pop-Tarts, and white rice. Yeah, let's put them in charge of occupational licensing. Great. My friend Don Willett down in Texas wrote the most pro-liberty economic, or the best economic liberty decision ever in a case involving eyebrow threaders. Look it up. It is a rousing defense of the most fundamental right that Americans possess, which is the right to put food on their family's table.
And I would also say sometimes we look at this kind of in a vacuum as if the occupational licensing is the only bulwark between, you know, terrible outcomes for consumers. We have market forces. It's very interesting that at a time when consumers have much, much more availability of information from, you know, the web, from online, you know, platforms, stuff like that, licenses have gone way up because it has reduced that consumer information asymmetry. There's also, you ask, is there a demand for unlicensed brain surgeons? Perhaps not. I mean, that's right. So that's, there are other elements that may play a role in how services get offered.
Right, but at the same time, I mean, you have to pass the medical exams, right? I had to convince some professors to give me my PhD. And so it's not as if you would go into a doctor and there wouldn't be evidence that they have training. So in that sense, it's not clear to me what the license is at giving an added benefit. I think it's more in the case where someone is not highly trained that the informational asymmetry may be relevant, but I think that the web is doing a very good job of reducing that problem.
I just want to add one thing. Is anybody in the room, I assume a lot of us are lawyers. By the way, Todd Zwicky back here. If you ever want to hear public choice theory in 45 minutes, go and beg him to just give you the 45-minute lecture. It's entertaining and informative. Has anybody ever had to go and find a lawyer for a friend or a family member? Because I had to do that a few times in the last few years. And I will tell you that whether that person was or was not licensed in a particular state was of exactly zero relevance to me. What I care about is reputational, information, and if I can find somebody who's had experience with that person. And I'm concerned, actually, that occupational licensing could lull people into a false sense of confidence. This guy's licensed by the state of Illinois. He must be great. No. And so I think occupational licensing actually might be counterproductive in some professions where you think it might help for a variety of reasons.
One more.
Carl Zabel with NetChoice. One of the things that we've been talking about is interstate work. It was mentioned about insurance portability across states. And now with the internet, I, as an attorney who's licensed to practice law in D.C., it would be great if I could practice law for my friend who lives in Virginia, but I can't. What type of economic impact have you seen to startup businesses like Zenefits encountered this problem where you had to be licensed in every state? What type of impact on new businesses have been suppressed by the licensing requirements on a state-to-state basis that eliminates kind of the economies of scale model that the internet provides?
Well, I can give you one concrete example. There was a wave in the funeral industry where corporate funeral homes essentially started displacing mom-and-pop funeral homes. Now, mom-and-pop funeral homes turn out to have a lot of economic efficiencies. Essentially, what you have is a funeral director who reads the sports pages 6 hours a day and then comes down to meet with families once in a while. There's some inefficiency in that system. corporate funeral homes came along and squeezed out a lot of that, those inefficiencies. Maybe they brought some things that weren't so great, but at least, you know, if you wanted to, you could get a much lower cost funeral. Maryland actually is the only state in the country, I believe, maybe New Hampshire, but in Maryland, it is illegal for corporations to own funeral homes. We challenged that law. You probably can guess what happened in court, so I won't bore you. But in Maryland, and then there are 50 grandfathered in corporations, and guess what? The ability to operate a funeral home in Maryland is very much like a taxi medallion. They're allowed to sell them. They're transferable, and they sell for up to $500,000. Why? Because it's better to do. And so here's the takeaway. It's very clear that law was put on the books for one reason and one reason only, and that is to keep out-of-state corporate funeral homes from penetrating the Maryland market. And if you have any doubts about, you know, why, is just go and ask a Maryland funeral director, and they will tell you why that law is on the books. And many of them love it, and I don't blame them.
I think, okay. So I'm glad people have lots more questions, but I think we've run out of time. So I just wanted to thank our panelists for an excellent discussion, and let's all keep fighting for economic liberty.